This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, July 14th, 1968. We keep coming back to 1968, listeners, and I suppose it's for a good reason, a very tumultuous year. But on this day in Hong Kong, reports started to trickle in about a sudden increase in patients with flu-like symptoms. This would lead to an influenza outbreak that swept the city within months, the rest of the world. We will get into the details, but I just want to paint two images right at the top here. In late 1968, up to half the adult population in Milwaukee in the United States did not show up for work due to being sick at home. And in Berlin, this flu killed so many people that bodies had to be stored in subway tunnels. So an influenza pandemic in the year of 1968. Let's talk about the H3N2 virus, also known as the Hong Kong flu. I'm joined, as always, by Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hey, Jody.
And our special guest today is Leon Nafok, host of the history podcast Fiasco, creator and host of the first two seasons of Slow Burn, and all-around lover of curious historical moments. Leon, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jody. Hi, Nikki.
Hey, Leon.
So, Leon, as with all good things, we're here because of a tweet. You, a couple weeks ago, tweeted something along the lines of, there was a flu in 1968 that killed a million people worldwide, and I feel like no one is talking about it. So let's start there. What caught your eye about this story?
Well, it was, if I'm not mistaken, I tweeted about it right as the death toll in the U.S. was inching towards 100,000, and I think I learned about this flu from a Time story where it was mentioned as, you know, as a reference point, like back in 1968, this many people died. And it just stunned me because 100,000 at that moment felt like so many. And I don't know, maybe it was just the way it was being covered. It just felt like every one of those was a death. And so suddenly to learn that many people had died in a flu epidemic not too long ago, like 1968, that's like 5 minutes ago. I just didn't understand how it hadn't been more of a reference point for people. And I didn't understand why I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, well, I think at least part of this is a media story, right? Because Leon, as you were sitting at your computer, you could watch the death toll rise in real time. What we know about this flu in 1968, that 34,000 to 100,000 people died, those are CDC estimates after the fact. So people at the time may not have known exactly how deadly the flu was.
Yeah, I think, and I obviously got a lot of responses from people who explained to me various aspects of epidemiology and how these kinds of estimates are arrived at. But I just kept coming back to the number because, you know, simultaneously as we were hitting 100,000, you would see people tweeting about, you know, this is 100,000 dead. That's 22 Iraq wars. It's 33 9/11s. And and you see that, you're like, Jesus, yeah, like that's so many. I just still kept coming back to the size of it. And I kind of cycle through being both satisfied that I get how this happened and also still befuddled.
I'm curious if we could talk a little bit about the way that it spread. I don't get the sense, and either of you correct me if I'm wrong here, but I don't get the sense that there was kind of like this immediate, like the entire world woke up to this and also galvanized around these hotspots like Northern Italy or New York City that were just being hammered in a way that really caught the world's attention.
Yeah, well, first of all, this flu didn't actually originate in Hong Kong. Right.
It was called the Hong Kong flu.
Right. Just like the 1918 flu was misnomered because of where there was a free enough press in order to talk about it. This originates in China. And this is actually part of the story then about the spread and the spread of the knowledge of the disease, because China was in the middle of a cultural revolution. Things were a little disorganized at the time, a little chaotic. But also, the U.S., the United Nations, they didn't recognize the People's Republic as the government of China. And so organizations like the World Health Organization aren't reporting data out of there. And so there's sort of this lack of knowledge because of the politics at the time that affect how much people know about the disease.
Jody, you were saying about how there wasn't like one day when everyone woke up. There wasn't a March 11th. I think that's absolutely right from what I understand. But there were also like a surprising number of disruptions to ordinary life that people were telling me sort of should be seen as the main difference between now and then. Like We canceled all of our sports seasons. Like, there have just been so many more large-scale disruptions as compared to then. But, you know, you read about, like, schools in, like, 23 states were closed. And so you sort of read things like that, and you wonder, like, why it didn't add up to sort of a national moment of consciousness or, like, reckoning of the kind that we are all going through together during this pandemic.
Yeah, I wonder if one of the answers, Leon, is that A, it didn't disrupt everyone's life in the same way at the same time as it has in the U.S. right now, but also that you were living in a time when disease affected people's lives much more often, right? There was a 57 epidemic of the flu. There was polio, which would have caused towns to shut down or close their schools or would disrupt life on a more regular basis than we've necessarily seen various diseases do in the last 20 to 30 years, probably since the AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, it's worth pointing out that the reason that a lot of us feel the disruption right now is not necessarily the disease itself, but the knockoff effects of the disease. And, you know, maybe there was a little less of that in 1968. But, you know, this was also, in reading back about it, this was also a disease that tended to kill older Americans. And I think that we're learning now that, like, even as disruptive as coronavirus is, there are, for a lot of people, just this gulf of disconnect with it because it is affecting a certain population. And I think that might be inevitable. And, you know, you read back about the 1918 flu, and that was something where, like, kids were getting it. Young people were getting it. Like, it was the disease itself was present in a way that maybe it's we're starting to learn about coronavirus is less so, though obviously the larger effects of it are massive and touching everyone. Mm-hmm. I want to do a little more on the kind of, like, how this fits into the story of 1968, 1969. But one thing about the kind of disease itself and the way that it was played, I mean, Nikki, perhaps not surprisingly, when you read about this, you see that it became politicized and it became a vector for all sorts of racist and sort of jingoistic narratives and storylines. So I guess no surprise there, right?
Yeah, we definitely see some continuities, especially on the racism front. It's known as the Hong Kong flu, and you get things like this billboard in Des Moines, Iowa that says, "Hong Kong flu is un-American. Catch something made in the USA." And you can see how that fits in with all of these other anxieties that are sort of swirling yeah. around about economic competition, racism, and just like jingoism, I guess. I mean, first of all, remember, the U.S. is at war at this time, right? It's the middle of the Vietnam War. And so anti-Asian racism in general is fairly high in the U.S. But it's also a time when the U.S. is about to hit the skids on the economy as well. So there are a lot of different anxieties at play here.
There are also, like, you know, examples of leaders blaming each other for the virus or stirring up nationalism on the basis of the virus. And it's obviously, you know, it's one of those things you look back and you're like, oh, they've been doing this for a while. And I think there's a certain logic to it when you think about it. On the one hand, a virus shouldn't be easy to politicize. You would think it's this, like, thing everyone recognizes is not taking orders from anyone. It's just doing its own thing. But at the same time, like, that's exactly what makes it such sort of valuable fodder for a propagandist. Like, you can take this invisible enemy and you can give it human form by saying it's, you know, your enemy's fault. And it can be really effective, I suspect.
Right. Although I think we're also feeling, I mean, we're seeing what you're describing here, and I think we're also feeling the shortfalls of trying to wage a quote-unquote war on something that isn't a nation and doesn't have sort of physical form, and the language and the sort of temperament of going to war against something like this just doesn't scan.
Yeah, although it fits in so nicely with Cold War tropes, like right. This idea that the communists are this invisible enemy that have invaded the U.S. and you don't know who's a communist and who's mm-hmm. trying to sort of spread the plague of communism through the country. And so that idea of an invisible enemy actually meshes so nicely, which is why it's kind of surprising that it doesn't end up getting called the Chinese flu, because China has a communist government and it would have just fit so well.
it was such a gimme, like,
right? Do right. your racism better.
So let's take a step back and talk a little bit about how we remember this, why we don't remember this, maybe circling back to kind of the initial question you had, Leon. But, you know, we've talked on this show. We did an episode a few weeks ago about Resurrection City, which was this encampment by the Poor People's Campaign on mm-hmm. the National Mall in 1968. And, you know, this thing that none of us really kind of remembered, but was kind of notable and amazing and a big deal at the time. And I think this falls into that category. And, you know, one of the things we discussed was just that inevitably through the process of history, you know, one or two storylines about a year get written and everything else falls away. And I mean, Leon, you know, your kind of whole thing is to cut against that and realize and pull at all the other strands that were going on at a given year. But so I'm curious kind of how you feel like the story of 1968 gets written and why this maybe tends to not be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot going on in 1968, and maybe it's just one of those things where we can only know so many. But I think like the feeling of when you read about this flu and what else was happening at the time, you realize like, oh God, like so many things can be happening at once. And I think that's like a reality about the present that we take for granted, but it's something that we don't necessarily extend to people from the past when we kind of imagine them living through events. You think about an event like, I don't know, just because it's on the top of my mind, but like Woodstock, like, oh, everyone was talking about Woodstock at the time. And that was the thing that was happening during that summer. But it's like, obviously that wasn't the case in real time, you know. Who knows how many people were even aware of Woodstock? They were thinking about many other things. And I think, yeah, like as you said, this is kind of one of the things we like to do on Fiasco is sort of remind people of what historical events that maybe exist on totally separate planes in their minds were actually happening simultaneously. And what that means for like which one wins and which one gets, you know, remembered is I think, just an ongoing question that we're always trying to answer on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and you know, I'll say, you know, what you do is not just say, oh, how neat all these other things are going on, but actually point out how they all kind of swirled together and led to the conditions of the time.
That's the hope.
Yes. Nikki, do you want to jump in on that? And then I have a bad take.
Great. Yeah, I mean, those connections are really important. And one we haven't talked about yet is that it was soldiers returning from the Vietnam War who helped carry this virus back to the U.S. So this isn't discrete from the stories that we already tell about 1968. It is very much a part of them and gives us just a much richer picture of all of the forces flowing together right at this moment.
Right, which is so interesting because, I mean, the story of 1918 is so connected to soldiers returning, and we think of war and flu as intertwined, and here, for some reason, that element doesn't fit into the narrative that comes out of that year.
I think we had enough reasons to think that the Vietnam War was bad without layering this on top.
Right, perhaps, yeah. Okay, here's my just bubbling up, probably pretty off idea, but like, I wonder if there's anything in here about age, and that like we kind of think of 1968 and the late 60s as a time of like youthful rebellion and the story of America being shaped by young people, and this is a disease that was affecting old people, and maybe just old people didn't have a part of the story of the late 60s in this country. I don't know.
I think it's an entirely plausible idea, Jody. I mean,
that is the highest compliment you could possibly pay that idea.
Well, the historical actors that we're paying the most attention to at this moment are young people, and also like, you know, we talked about this when we talked about the 1918 flu. Woodrow Wilson got it. Lyndon Johnson got this flu, but he's on his way out, right?
He gave it to an astronaut.
Oh yes, we have to mention that tidbit.
Maybe two astronauts actually who went to space and came down with it in space.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we were at the end of LBJ's story. Like, it just didn't really matter that he got this flu.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. Okay, well, let's wrap up there with the 1968 flu, but I do want to do a few also on this day's because there's some interesting ones. On this day, July 14th, this was flagged to us by a listener, Tane, so thank you for that. In 1948, Minneapolis Mayor Hubert Humphrey spoke to the Democratic National Convention, urging the party to, quote, get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights. Nikki, 1948, he's making that? What do we make of that statement by Humphrey?
Well, you should know that 1948 was the year that a bunch of Southern Democrats broke away and formed the Dixiecrat Party because they were frustrated with the party's move towards greater acceptance of civil rights. And 16 years later, Hubert Humphrey is the lead author of the Civil Rights Act and then will join LBJ's ticket as his vice president.
All right. And then in 1865, the Chickasaw Nation is the last of the five tribes to surrender to the Union following the Confederate defeat.
Just like in the War for Independence, indigenous nations knew not to side with the U.S. government, that it was not in their interests.
And then one more, and Leon, I know this is right up your alley, so we'll give you a chance to chime in on this one. But in 1999, on July 14th, race-based school busing in Boston ended after 25 years. And I guess we can tell people this is the subject of the next season of Fiasco, right?
That's right. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, we are doing our third season on the desegregation of Boston's public schools, which is a story that begins in 1963 and kind of is about what happened when the civil rights movement, which had been sweeping the South, what happened when it came north, and what happened when civil rights leaders confronted people in the North who didn't see themselves as being implicated by racism or Jim Crow laws. What happened when civil rights leaders confronted them and said, no, in fact, this is a problem here too. And so busing in Boston is sort of a microcosm of that reckoning.
And, you know, you said it's a story that starts in 1963. To me, the thing that pops out here is it's a story that ends in 1999.
I know, right.
I think let's say that, you know, later this summer or, you know, when your season is out, I think we should find a time to do a proper episode on busing because, yeah, it is so fascinating. We'll have you back on. But that is it for this episode. So, Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thanks, Jody.
And Leon Nafuk, host of Fiasco, thank you.
Thanks, Jody.
And I will say, Leon will be back for a couple more episodes later this month. But coming up on Thursday, we will move to 1863 and talk about the New York City draft riots, a story that, let's say, complicates a lot of our narratives about the North and the Civil War. Really interesting story. And listeners, before I go, one big announcement. Starting this Sunday, we are going to be going 3 days a week with this show. Nikki, are you ready? 3 days a week?
I'm ready. I'm warming up.
Okay, yes. You know, we'll talk a little bit more about our thinking around this when we do our episode on Sunday. But basically, with the election season heating up, you do remember the election, right? There are just a ton of election-related stories we want to talk about, and this is our way to make space for that. So we will be Tuesday, Thursday, and a weekend edition on Sunday, starting this Sunday. So look out for that. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Follow us on social media. We're posting a bunch of stuff on Twitter and Instagram every day, posting about big moments and small moments, way more than we get to on this podcast. So follow at This Day Pod. You can also email us thisdaypod@gmail.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.